Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we're talking about getting back to school while not going back to school. First, we've heard a lot about online classwork, but how about for the youngest kids? Should kindergartners even be starting school this year? And Kansas City Public Schools launched a new TV program this morning to help families with kids learning at home. We'll talk about that, too. Later, the smart money experts are here to talk about the economy and the stock market and why they seem to be moving in opposite directions. But first up, it's KCUR's Sam Zeff bringing us up to speed on what the newsroom is working on today. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
So let's start with the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Deborah Birx, the head of that task force, was in town over the weekend. She arrived as cases in the metro have been spiking. Bring us up to speed on the numbers.
So the Mid-America Regional Council tracks the 9-county metro region, and yesterday, according to their dashboard, 608 new COVID-19 cases in that 9-county region, 431 deaths since the pandemic began. Missouri Health Department reports this morning 67,000 cases. In Kansas, the Health Department reports almost 34,000. We will get new numbers from Kansas today. They report only Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
All right. So things not necessarily heading the right direction there. The Democratic National Convention gets underway today as well. It's going to be a very different kind of convention, Sam. What do local Democratic leaders have to say?
Super duper different, actually. Yeah. Johnson County Congresswoman Charisse David, she's one of 8 vice chairs of the convention. She's a freshman, and that's when any incumbent, as you know, is most vulnerable. So this is a good political platform for her. The convention, mostly virtual, as we said, but that doesn't mean that it's dampened Democratic spirits. Here's Kansas City Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, followed by Davis.
We've got to be there supporting them. We don't need any negativity. We need to support what I believe to be a significant ticket, maybe one of the best tickets ever.
The convention is an opportunity for us to come together and remember exactly why we're in this fight and who we're fighting for. You know, the convention stage is bigger this year than ever.
So I ask Congresswoman David where she's going to be participating in the convention from.
Right.
She said her house in Roland Park. She bought a brand new couch. But at this point, she tells me she does not have balloons nor any straw hats for the DNC.
I appreciate you asking the tough questions, Sam. If you're not unemployed right now, there is a good chance that you know someone who is. We've been hearing about it. What's the status in Kansas, at least, of that $400 in federal money that the president has promised?
Yeah, that $400 a week would replace the $600 weekly federal subsidy. And the answer this morning is we just don't know. Here's Jim McLean.
Kansas Department of Labor Secretary Ryan Wright says there are just too many unanswered questions about the president's plan.
There's a couple of challenges here, just to be real candid with you in implementing that.
Briefing state lawmakers last week, Wright said it's not clear the state can afford to match the federal funds. Plus, he said the pool of Homeland Security money set aside for the program isn't enough to last very long. So, with Congress working on a more comprehensive coronavirus relief package,
it may make more sense to wait and implement that.
But Wright said congressional negotiators must work quickly to replace emergency payments that many out-of-work Kansans lost at the end of last month when an earlier relief program expired. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Jim McLean in Topeka.
And we'll be talking more about that federal relief that is under discussion later in the show with our smart money experts. Sam Zeff, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Brian.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. When students head back to school over the next few weeks in our area, many, maybe even most, won't actually head back to school. At least to start the year, online learning will be the rule of the day. We've talked a lot about how teachers and students are translating classroom habits into Zoom calls and YouTube videos and chat groups, but what if you're 5? How does kindergarten work if you've never really learned what school normally is in the first place? And should parents even be starting their kids' formal schooling this year, or should they wait? Carly Pruitt is a teacher, a K-3 reading interventionist at Troost Elementary, and she joins us this morning. Carly, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. I know you've been teaching for a while, right?
Yes. I'm embarking on my 21st year.
And although you're a reading specialist now, you spend a lot of time teaching kindergartners, right?
Yes, 18 years of my career has been teaching kindergarten.
I guess I'm curious, working at Troost Elementary last spring when the pandemic started, what was the impact you saw, especially on the younger kids that you work with?
I think that the impact was a lot of our students were not very versed in using a computer for the majority of their learning. So we started to see that a lot of our kids started dropping off. Not as many were showing up. We were doing a lot of reaching out to parents to see what was going on, and really what it came down to was our parents just didn't know how to navigate through digital learning, and so in that case, our students pretty much missed out on a whole quarter of school.
So it wasn't just an issue of the kids not being able to handle it. It was parents as well.
Absolutely.
Let's take a step back and talk about what kindergarten is sort of for in the first place. I mean, when you think about what you're trying to accomplish in that first year of school, what is it? Why do we bring kids together in that particular way at that age in their life?
Well, really, that first year of school is teaching kids social skills, what the expectations are in a classroom, how to be in a classroom with 20 or more other students and take directions from an adult that they really don't know or they're not used to. And then we're establishing all their foundational skills. Even if a student comes in and they don't have a lot of foundational skills, that is where they learn what is school about, what are our social skills, how do we get along, and then just really the basics of the alphabet and numbers and all of those foundations that they will build on for the rest of their school career.
So when you talk about all those social skills, all that learning to interact with others or listen to a teacher, it seems like those are skills that would be nearly impossible to learn sitting in front of a screen at home.
Yes, it's a little more challenging. But even the youngest of our students, they really just need to know what the expectations are. Children will always rise to what our expectations are, and as long as we're clear, they may be moving around a little bit more on a screen than they might be in a classroom, but we can still work on some of those basic skills even online.
So those basic skills, when it comes to learning really how to read or the beginnings of how to read, those building blocks you mentioned, the ABCs, what are the basic elements of doing that? What would you be doing in the classroom in the first, let's say, month of school in that regard?
As far as reading is concerned, that's where we would start our foundations of, are they holding a book correctly? Do they turn the pages in the right direction? Do they understand that words go from left to right? And even if they're not able to read the words, can they make up a story as they're looking at the pictures? Basic introduction to, these are letters, they make a sound. Rhyme, can they hear when words have similar sounds? Can they isolate sounds? Things like that. So it's really a lot of those basic things that we learn as we go in the primary grade.
And yet, just to use an example that you just gave, you can't really be sure that the student is holding their book correctly if you aren't there in the room with
right.
them. So what do you
it's
do?
It's a little more challenging. I think you can still have kids, if they have books in the home and you're teaching a lesson like that, you can still have kids demonstrate on the screen for you. It's not going to be quite as effective if you're sitting right in front of them, and you can turn the book around and you can point for them. But there are some ways that we can demonstrate online. And if parents have the opportunity to sit next to their children, that is also very beneficial, because parents can see things that we are doing in the classroom to help their children, and then they are able to do the same at home.
And maybe that is a point that we need to talk about. You're talking about the role of parents in assisting in this kind of learning. I know parents are important in learning even when the kids are coming to the classroom, but it seems absolutely critical now.
Oh, absolutely. What I found was that I noticed that several of my intervention students that I worked with over the springtime, parents would sit right next to them if they had the opportunity to do so, just to see what I was teaching and what I was showing their students. I understand that parents have to work. I'm a working mom myself. But if they have the opportunity to sit next to their child when their child is doing online work, if they're not available when the teacher is doing live sessions, at least when they're doing that independent work, if they can sit next to them and see what they're learning and what they're doing, that would be the most beneficial to both the parent and the child.
And what if they can't? I mean, a lot of that depends on the parent's own capacity for teaching their child, and not to mention the time, as you mentioned, if they're busy working. What if they can't?
I think that there's also lots of resources out there for our younger kiddos. Just reading to them, letting them listen to stories online. There are so many resources out there where kids can listen to read-alouds, and that is one of the best things you can do for a young child is read to them every day. And I also think that, you know, PBS offers good opportunities, so if you just don't have the time to do that, at least put them in front of educational things.
And we'll be talking in our later segment this morning about KCPS's new television show as well.
Yes.
So I guess I'm just curious technically how it will work. Walk us through the experience of a parent sitting down with their five-year-old for their first day of kindergarten when the first day of kindergarten is going to be looking at a screen.
I think it's just going to be—it's going to be new for everybody, including the teacher. I think a lot of the first days will really be a lot of introductory things. Teachers are going to be building relationships with children in a new way. I think a lot of it will just be getting to know you types of things and navigating their way through the technology. I know that a lot of schools are providing a parent university or some open house opportunities for parents to learn how to help their children through using the technology, but I think it's just going to be something we've never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, will a kid be looking at a Zoom screen full of faces of other children, or will there be one-on-one interaction with the teacher? How will that work?
There will be a little bit of both. There are some opportunities throughout the day that teachers will be doing large group lessons where they will have the entire class. But there will also be opportunities for small group. The way we've set up our schedules in my district is that we are just, the younger students may only be doing about 15 minutes of a large group activity where they might be working in a small group with two or three other students with their teacher. So that gives that teacher an opportunity to get to know them a little better. I will be working with four students at a time for no more than about 15 or 20 minutes, just because your attention span online is going to be much shorter than it would be.
Which is something adults have found out as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And yet I've been pretty amazed at the amount of attention a child can give when it involves looking at a screen.
Oh, yes. They are. Technology is just the wave of the future, of course, and our students are definitely used to being on devices, and devices can keep their attention a little bit easier sometimes than we can in the classroom.
You mentioned the way you'll be interacting with kids sort of four at a time. You're a reading interventionist. You sort of work with kids who are often having trouble reading. Are there particular techniques or things that you have been trained or are trying to be trained in how to use when you are working with people virtually?
I've kind of had to just adapt things a little bit. I've made some interactive things that I would normally have in front of the students that they'll be able to pull up on their screen and manipulate letters and sounds to build words.
Hmm.
I also just finished a dyslexia program, and it actually worked fairly well one-on-one with students in the spring. Kids that I had been working on a practicum with, they just had to show me things, and we held up a lot of whiteboards and things like that, but there's always ways to adapt. It may not be as user-friendly if they were right in front of you, but we can adapt to make things work for our students.
I know that some parents are thinking about holding their kids back if they would have started kindergarten this year. And, of course, that's a choice that parents have to make even under normal circumstances. Do you think that's a good idea? Is there a benefit to saying, you know what, maybe when next year things are a little bit more normal, that would be a better time for my kid to start school?
I think it's on a child-by-child basis, of course. If you choose not to enroll your child in kindergarten at this time, it still would not be a bad idea to find an early childhood program or something where they will still get that opportunity to learn this year. We really don't want kids just sitting in idle for another year,
right,
and then they come in a little bit behind their peers. So even if parents opt to keep them out, I highly recommend that parents still put them in some kind of educational program or continue to work with them in another way.
Is there a plan for how to evaluate how well this is working for figuring out whether the kids 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks into this are actually getting it?
Well, we're working on all kinds of formative and summative assessments to kind of see how our kiddos are doing, and those small groups will be a huge part of how we determine if children are getting it.
I guess I'm curious, Carly, you've been teaching, as you said, for a couple of decades. How are you feeling going into this year? Is there excitement about the new thing, or is there anxiety about wondering how it's going to work?
There's a lot of anxiety. I've been at my school for 3 years. I know my kids, and I'm worried about some of them being engaged and getting online. A lot of anxiety of trying to figure out how to make this all work, but there has been a lot of excitement, too. Teachers have learned so much through this process. We've definitely become more tech savvy and figured out other ways to reach our kids. So I would love to see the kids. I miss them. I miss my colleagues. But we will make it work.
Well, you've got a lot of folks pulling for you and appreciating the hard work that you're doing, Carly. That's Carly Pruitt. She's a teacher, a K-3 reading interventionist at Troost Elementary. She joined us from Raymore this morning. Carly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. School starts 3 weeks from tomorrow in the Kansas City Public Schools, and it will start entirely online. It will be a different kind of school year, and a lot of parents are worried about how to navigate it. But KCPS got an early start this morning with one project designed to bridge the gap between classroom and couch. What if some of that morning TV viewing isn't cartoons, but calculation, not game shows, but grammar? And it's, of course, not just for kids in KCPS either. Kelly Wachel is Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Kansas City Public Schools, and she's here to talk about the KCPS Homeroom, which aired its first episode this morning. Kelly, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
So tell us, what is KCPS Homeroom?
Well, like you mentioned in your brief intro, it is designed to provide kids, not only KCPS kids, but kids across the region, on 38th The Spot, access to academic content, well, not on a computer, but on the TV. And so it's our teachers working through the TV screen to teach and have fun with kids while they're at home.
Now, presumably, they are already getting some of that education, I mean, hopefully a lot of that education online, on computer screens and so on. Why do this? What does having a TV program add to that equation?
Sure, great question, because we asked ourselves the same thing. So yes, while we're doing distance learning, you just had heard Carly talking about it from Troost Elementary, while we're doing the distance learning and the virtual academy learning through online resources and with our teachers in KCPS, we also thought that those who might have difficulty, while we are giving hotspots, internet access, and devices to all of our kids, we thought sometimes that hotspot, the internet connectivity, can be a little bit tricky or go in and out depending on how many kids are in the home, which is another problem in itself. But we thought if we can provide a TV show with engaging content, it's just one more way, one more resource to provide that content in our kids' homes absent the internet connection issues.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that engaging content. You've chosen to arrange the show day by day around different subjects, but you're also trying to reach different grade levels.
Correct. Yeah, we have primary, upper elementary, middle school, high school content that we're airing on KCPS Homeroom. We got a tweet this morning on our KCPS account that said, "Oh my gosh, I'm learning about integrated equations again on my TV. Thanks, KCPS."
Wow. So, I should be watching this, I think, in that case. Well, in fact, I was watching a little of this morning, truthfully, and a number of us were around the station. The first episode aired at 8 a.m. this morning. Let's take a little bit of a listen to hear just a taste of KCPS Homeroom.
Good morning, Kansas City. Let's get ready to learn on KCPS Homeroom. I'm Justin Robinson, your homeroom instructor. Today is Math Monday. First, we'll have a math lesson for kindergarten through second grade, followed by a lesson for third through sixth, then middle school, and finally, high school math, K through two. Are you ready to learn? All right, let's go meet your teacher, Ms. Barnes.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Math Mondays. I'm Miss Barnes, and together we are going to be learning about big math concepts for learners just like you. Today we're going to be talking about place value. Have you ever wondered why numbers are different sizes?
And yet, we won't be sharing the answer to that question this morning on Up to Date. You'll have to tune in to find out. Kelly, it seems like it's a real challenge to reach kids K through 12 all in the same one-hour program.
Yeah, that's why, you know, as we were having the discussions about production and format and how we were going to do this for our kids and for our families, you know, as you heard, we segmented it by Math Mondays, ELA Tuesdays, and each day has its own content area. And then we have 15-minute segments for each grade level broken up within that hour. So we've launched this. We're going to kind of let it ride for a couple weeks, see what kind of feedback we get. And if we need to change to, you know, Monday is all lower elementary, Tuesday is upper elementary, we wanted to be able to hit all kids in the same hour without having them wait for a day of the week. So trying to compress all of the grade levels into 1 hour, give them 15-minute increments, and just kind of make sure that we were hitting a sprinkle of things throughout every day.
And ELA stands for English Language Arts. I had to look it up myself.
Correct.
So we heard Miss Barnes there. Is Miss Barnes a real math teacher in the Kansas City schools?
Miss Barnes is. She's actually one of our math curriculum coordinators. So because our teachers hadn't started when we started producing the show, we used all of our curriculum coordinators who are former teachers who now oversee curriculum content areas within the district. So these awesome coordinators have spent the last 3 to 4 weeks with us producing and using their talent to teach kids via video. But once school starts, yes, we're going to engage and pull in more of our classroom teachers to help us with the lessons. And we've already got lots of recruits in the wings and people who are very eager to be on TV teaching our kids.
Well, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, does it seem like more work for these teachers, or does it seem like something they're kind of excited to do? It's certainly different than your audience being just the 20 to 30 kids in front of you.
Yeah, and that, you know, we have, again, we have real well-rounded, really talented teachers who we're finding those rock star teachers certainly want to participate because, again, they have so much talent. They want to use it in many ways. Our intention, though, is not to double their work from the classroom teacher perspective. It's actually to set up a camera with them, set up some lights, set up some microphones, and actually just record them while they're teaching their online lessons for their class.
The work they would be doing anyway.
The work they would be doing anyway. You're correct, Brian. So we don't see it as an extra, but just an enhancement for what they're already doing.
So I know you're a parent, Kelly, and I think we've talked in our last segment on kindergarten about how parental involvement is really important. How does this fit into what parents are doing with their kids? Are you hoping that the TV program is something they watch together and talk about, or is the thought that this is a little bit of a reprieve for the parents for at least 15 or 20 minutes each day to let someone else do the teaching?
I think it could be a bit of both, right? I think it's a great opportunity for parents and kids to watch and discuss and ask each other questions and provide some dialogue. But I also think, yes, you know, as parents, particularly ones who are working from home during the pandemic while their kids are learning from home, it could provide a great opportunity for the students to kind of get with their day, start with the TV program, and then get into their online coursework with their teachers or through their virtual platform. So we see it as a both, as an offering for both. And not only is it for KCPS kids, but it's for kids around the region. Those students who have 38 the spot, it reaches well beyond Kansas City's boundaries. So we just see it as a service, as a resource, and one that could be entertaining while not glued to your computer screen for the whole day.
You talk about entertaining, and I do think that there is a sense that a lot of children's television is about entertainment, and I've even heard a hesitation on a lot of parents' parts or concern about how much television their children watch. Are you concerned at all about that, or are you worried that you're encouraging something that is a double-edged sword in getting kids to watch TV?
Well, I think we have to look at it as this is a different time. And because we're doing schooling a little bit differently, whether it's online through your computer screen or through your TV screen, They talk about screen time in different buckets, right? You know, screen time on video games is different than screen time on academic content. So yes, we, as a parent, as an educator, we always get a little bit worried about that amount of screen time. I know our pediatricians worry about screen time as well. And so it's a balance. It's all a healthy balance that we try to do between the distance learning piece and then this TV piece. But we see it as a choice for parents to have access to, as a service that we're providing, and one where people can make, again, choices for how they use their screen time.
You know, there are certain things that can't be taught through a screen. We've talked about that in other conversations. I know that the Friday episodes of the show are dedicated to what's listed as fine arts and life skills. What are some of the ways that you're trying to kind of reach even beyond the traditional academic topics with this show to sort of create some of the rest of what a kid would be getting if they were going to school?
We really see that Friday show as a point where we introduce some of our students actually to come use Student Voice and use their talents to introduce some of their talents and skills to the broader audience. We also see life skills, whether it's PE, whether it's activity, whether it's yoga. We have lots of programs in our schools that serve kids in ways beyond academic content. And so we're looking at it that way. And then we're also looking at we were going to introduce this year some Black history courses, African American history courses, and Hispanic heritage courses into our curriculum this year to service the history of Kansas City and really honor our demographics. And so we see that spot also as a possible way to introduce some of that richer history conversation into our shows.
I want to, do you need to get the phone there, Kelly?
So we have a home phone, and I apologize, it never rings, but of course it's ringing right now.
Of course. Well, that's all right. We're okay. Let me ask you just one more question. Tell us all when and where they can find the program, because I'm sure there are a lot of folks who've heard this and are thinking they want to check it out for themselves.
So it airs at 8 o'clock Monday through Fridays on 30th of Spot. It's an 8 to 9 o'clock show. And we're getting ready to post on our social accounts kind of the broadcast schedule, what the content areas are each day, along with the age group segments that will be airing each day.
I know folks can also find it online on YouTube, right?
Correct. Yeah, we'll air all of our shows on YouTube. So we'll recycle those on YouTube and also highlight some of them on our social accounts once we have some really good hits under our belt.
Very good. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and I hope it works out well. That's Kelly Wachel. She's Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for KCPS. Kelly, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. When we come back, by all accounts, the economy is in a world of hurt, and yet our retirement accounts and the stock market don't really look so bad. How can that be? Our smart money experts are here to answer that and other COVID-19 personal finance questions, so stay tuned. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. We are in a recession. Unemployment is skyrocketing. Washington can't get together on a stimulus and relief package. And yet, the stock market. Stock prices are almost back to where they were before the pandemic in February, which was an all-time high. So what gives? And what does it all mean for what you and I should be doing with our money, if we have it? We are joined this morning by our smart money experts. Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Brian.
And we're still trying to get Sandy Weaver on the line, founder of Weaver Financial and Mission. So we'll come back for Sandy in just a moment. I should mention, too, that the information presented by our guests is for informational purposes only, should not be construed as a recommendation or advice related to your personal situation. So please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decision. Barbara, we're going to talk in a bit about where we are on getting some relief from Washington. But first, let's talk about the economy right now and how it's affecting people. And let's start with this. We hear the word recession. A lot of us don't really know what that means. How bad is it right now?
Oh, it's bad. So let me give you the proper definition of a recession. It typically is two consecutive quarters of an economic decline. But what's interesting is that the National Bureau of Economic Research announced that we were in a recession officially on June 8th, even though we hadn't had these two consecutive declines in the economy.
It was bad enough,
and what they said
even
was,
without the
it
extra
was bad
quarter.
Enough. Yeah, we know it when we see it, and this is a recession. So that was kind of an amusing, if you will, way to get it going.
In a macabre sort of way. Sandy Weaver, founder of Weaver Financial Admission. Are you there with us now, Sandy?
Yes, I am, Brian and Barbara. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Sorry for the difficulty with the connection this morning. And another factor, of course, in what's bad about the economy, Sandy, is unemployment, right?
Yes. We came in with a 14.7% unemployment rate in April, which was a high. We are now down to 10.2% in July, which, you know, is excellent news, but it's still an almost unprecedented high rate in unemployment, something that we haven't seen since 2008, 2009, when we were in the Great Recession. We had a lot of people out of work.
Well, and to that point, Barbara, the impact on businesses and on the engines of the economy has been devastating.
Oh, it really has, because the economy is fueled primarily by economic spending. And so the economy cooled off, corporate earnings started to drop. It's estimated that in the second quarter of this year, corporate earnings were down 33.8% if you compare it to a year ago. That's a significant decline.
Mm-hmm. And yet, is there, Barbara, are there any signs of improvement?
Well, there are. There are some bright spots. These have started to pop up in the last couple of months. If you look at retail sales, housing, auto sales, manufacturing, those are the bright spots. And the hope is that they might signal maybe that the worst is over.
So whether the worst is over or not, we're still in a pretty bad place. Sandy, when you see economic numbers like this, we've painted a pretty bleak picture. What does it mean for the average Joe or Jane? Obviously, if we don't have a job, we notice that. But even if we are still working, what's the impact of all this?
One of the impacts has been that people are saving more. We've had an unprecedented amount of credit card balances paid down. On the other hand, Barbara did mention retail sales, retail spending, and that has done an amazing recovery. Even manufacturing is coming back. So from the average Joe, you know, a lot of people are making sure they have good reserves, a good emergency fund. They're saving a little bit more. They're not playing it so close to the edge with a lot of credit card debt.
How about the impact on companies and businesses going forward? I think a lot of us think about our restaurants in our neighborhood and the places that we haven't been able to go that we like to go. But it's bigger than just those companies that we see, right? Are they looking at a more positive future at the moment?
Somewhat depends on the size. You know, your bigger companies have deeper credit lines they can pull on. What we've seen are the smaller businesses and the mom and pops. You know, they were able to navigate through, you know, March, April, but the continued slowdown, if you're in the wrong industry, say, as you mentioned, a restaurant, you know, you need to be able to have enough curbside, enough limited capacity seating, you know, in order to hang on until, you know, things return to somewhat of a normal. So it depends what kind of small business you are. And we are seeing more bankruptcies. You know, we've all noted that JCPenney and some of the other common ones, you know, we've had Hertz have gone down through this.
Right. Really blue chip companies, places you thought would never go out of business.
Yeah, yeah. And we all know of the restaurant down the street that we used to frequent that's no longer there. So, but you will see more smaller business bankruptcies or smaller businesses going out of business than your larger ones.
So then let me ask you, Barbara, we can talk more about the general economy, but let's turn to the stock market. I still remember some pretty crashy stock market days just a few months ago, but but slowly but surely, that's pretty much taking care of itself, right?
In some sectors, yes. So what you're thinking back to is March, when the market hit the bottom at a decline of 34%. which was absolutely eye-popping. Mm-hmm. But right now, what's going on is the Standard & Poor 500, S&P 500, is up over 2%. NASDAQ, which is predominantly tech companies, is up an astonishing 23.5%. Now, the one that most people watch, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, not quite as broad. It's only 30 stocks. It's still down about 2%. I think the S&P 500 is a better indicator. And as I said, it's up a little over 2%. So what you remember, that 34% down, there's been a nice slow creep, and we are flat to positive for the year in many markets.
So the $64,000 question, or probably a lot more than that, how can the stock market be doing so well when the economy is doing so poorly? Sandy?
I think part of it is the economy isn't doing quite as poorly as everybody thinks. You know, we are still struggling mightily with COVID, but the economic numbers, you know, really considering what we've been through, are coming back as expected, and are starting to look pretty healthy. You know, as Barbara mentioned again, you know, so much of our economy is predicated on consumer spending. Well, retail sales are doing pretty good. So you see a lot of that. A lot of businesses aren't impacted that much by COVID. You know, we tend to focus on the ones that are, but a lot of businesses are not. You know, housing is another one that's doing fine. So, you know, the economy is not doing as badly, and the future looks pretty bright because of the improvements made, progress made on the medical front. So the market does have a look ahead, you know, 6, 9, 12, 18 months. And what the market is seeing, that's what you're seeing in the market's numbers today.
So, Barbara, I'm sorry, Sandy. I was just going to ask Barbara, is that what we're seeing? The stock market is sort of a crystal ball on the future of the economy. Is that an indication that things are heading the right direction?
That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah. I think I want to stress is that the stock market and the economy are not the same thing. And just to make the same point that Sandy did, the stock market is a leading economic indicator. It measures the value of companies in a certain market. And one of the analysis or the comparisons that we're seeing is that we are facing a valley, that the economy is tipping on a valley, and we're looking down, and the valley looks ugly. But the stock market's looking on the other side. And with every economic indicator, the market looks down into the valley and goes, oh, well, I understand that. I know that. I can identify it. I know how to respond. I'm going to keep looking to the other side and see how it is we recover.
We'd love to hear what questions you have for our smart money experts. Call 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Not your specific personal finance questions necessarily, but the information that might help you make the kinds of decisions you want to make. 816-235-2888. We're with Sandy Weaver of Weaver Financial in Mission and Barbara McMahon of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. All right. So, friends, let's say hypothetically that a listener still has a job, at least for now. They've got a little something saved for retirement, and the stock market is their stocks are doing fine. Should they be doing anything differently, generally speaking, in light of this economic situation? Sandy?
Yes. You still want to make sure that you have a diversified portfolio. You don't want to have everything invested in stocks, nor do you want to have everything invested in bonds. You should have some higher risk assets, some lower risk investments, some based in economic activity here in the U.S., some based in economic activity overseas. You also want to mix it up between large company stocks and small company stocks. And what we just talked about a few minutes ago, you know, says why you want to do that. So having a diversified portfolio of investments is really important. A second thing that clients that I've worked with have been doing is making sure they have a good emergency fund and have started to raise cash for projects they're going to be needing in the next 1 to 2 to 3 years.
I mean, Barbara, that sounds like advice that at least having a balanced, diverse portfolio sounds like advice you would give to clients at any time, right?
Well, it absolutely is. And what we would recommend at any time is that they reevaluate it typically once a year, or when there's been a significant shift in the market, as there has been recently. It's kind of what I like to call the sleep at night factor. So I can tell you in our office, the way the conversations go with clients are, how is your family and loved ones? Because frankly, that's the most important thing. The second question, to go back to Sandy's point about an emergency fund, is, do you need any money soon for anything? I've been talking to a lot of clients about down payments on homes that they think they're going to need shortly. And the third thing is, can you sleep at night, or did that decline in March scare you? Do we need to think about putting you in a different portfolio? So we're starting to look at a lot of clients who are inching toward retirement, and where the stock market was going up, they were very comfortable. Now they realize they don't have a whole lot of years left while they're still going to be in the job market. And maybe the portfolio they were comfortable with at the beginning of the year is not the one they're comfortable with right now.
So maybe the comfort level, just how you feel, is an important
exactly.
consideration.
I think so.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions for our smart money experts. Dale is calling from Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Dale.
Good morning to you all. I was wondering, do the ladies think it would be, the economy would be rip-roaring as they kind of commented is, if it was not, if the money from the unemployment funds is not approved?
And that's a good question, Dale, one that we in fact do want to talk about this morning. He's asking about the holdup in Washington on getting additional unemployment benefits, or the benefits that did exist previously, extended. What's going to be the impact if Congress and the White House can't come together on that? Sandy?
Well, continuing claims are still 16 million, which says, you know, we still have that many people who are scrambling for jobs and looking. They are already stretched, as we know. And if we don't get a phase two on another CARES Act, some kind of unemployment assistance on that, we will notice that in the economy, because usually those unemployment claims paid to those folks get spent right away and not saved because they have pressing needs like food and rent. You know, so we will notice that. And that will set us back some if we don't get that.
Barbara, how much does it hurt that there hasn't been an agreement yet on another stimulus and relief package?
It has hurt, and it actually has hurt the stock market, because the stock market's kind of reflecting on the day's news, kind of, again, looking into that valley and seeing if they understand what's going on in the valley. And a really good demonstration of that was last Tuesday, when the market was up, yeah, pretty significant amount all day, until Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made the comment that the two sides were pretty far apart on the agreement, and the market plunged just mm-hmm. before it closed. So it will affect both the economy, because the economy is consumer spending, as Sandy says, that money goes directly into the economy for things that people need. But the stock market has baked in the notion that this will return, that there will be a relief package and people will be assisted as we move through the COVID crisis.
So with Congress unable to come to an agreement, the Republicans and Democrats together and the White House, the president, President Trump, issued a handful of executive orders earlier this month. Sandy, remind us at least of some of what those executive orders did. He did actually extend unemployment benefits, though not at the level they were at before.
Yes, that's true. They were a combination of executive orders and memorandums. The first go-around from the Trump administration was $400 a week instead of the $600, and $100 of the $400 was supposed to be a kicker by the states. And then they backed off that within about 3 days of releasing that, when they came to realize that the state unemployment systems really can't make that happen easily very fast.
They've had enough trouble with the existing benefit.
Exactly, you know. So then it was down to $300. The money would come from unspent FEMA funds, emergency funds. It would also, though, probably be exhausted in 5 to 6 weeks. The states, however, right now are, you know, backing off, backing away from having to put in that $100 kicker. And so there's really been no progress on that. So also, though, it's important to keep in mind that the state average unemployment assistance is about $300, you know, a week. So it's not as if you're part of that $16 million continuing claims, it's not as if you're not going to get anything, but you won't get, you know, the more lucrative benefits that you were getting before.
Meanwhile, another of the president's orders set up a delay of payroll tax collection. Barbara, that's something that the president wanted that Congress has been a lot less enthusiastic about.
That's a good way of stating it, Brian. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is under the proposal, it calls for a delay of payment of workers' payroll taxes, and that would occur from September 1st to December 31st. So what they're talking about is that 6.2% that goes into Social Security. They're also talking about a deferral, not a forgiveness. So it doesn't come out of your payroll now, which technically means if you're still employed, you're going to get a 6.2% raise. But deferral means delayed. And so you would have to pay it back later. And employers are very concerned about this because they don't necessarily know how they're going to track that. What happens if a worker leaves and you've deferred it? What happened? There's a concern that employers will be on the hook for this amount if starting January 1, they try to recover it. So when Trump issued the initiative, he, I think, made it fairly clear that he expects Congress to come back in and forgive it and just say, we're starting over January 1, it's gone, we're done with it, we're moving on.
Which Congress has by no means suggested they are willing to do.
Exactly.
So, I mean, let me ask you both, like, if this actually takes effect here in September and people see that bump in their paycheck, what should they do? Maybe they shouldn't spend it. Is that what you're suggesting?
A lot of people
That's a really...
Sorry, go ahead, Sandy.
I'm sorry. Yes, a lot of people will save it because now, of all times, is the time to make sure that you don't have a lot of high interest rate debt, that, you know, you have a really good emergency fund and reserve set up because you don't know what's coming down the pike.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Barbara.
Well, no, Sandy pretty much said what I did. I also want to make the point that this only applies to people who make less than $104,000 a year. So I have a feeling that these benefits will help the people that frankly need it. Maybe they've been reduced to part-time where they had been full-time. That money will go directly into the economy because they have things that they need to buy. But the savings rate is ticking up, and I suspect those people that don't necessarily need it to meet their daily needs will save it for the future.
Invite listeners again to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. What do you need to know about your own financial decisions? Looking into your own crystal ball about what kind of help and stimulus and relief might be on the way. I know that the president's orders included some other things, continued payment relief for student loan debt, eviction protections, but Congress is still trying to hash something out that the White House will sign. What else is left to be done? Sandy, what's most important at this point?
Well, I think they are still... beyond student loans and eviction protections, you know, one of the big sources of contention is how much assistance needs to go back to state and local governments.
Mm-hmm.
You have the proposal by the Democrats is $3.4 trillion. The proposal by the Republicans is $1 trillion. And a lot of that difference is how much should go back to state and local governments.
And Barbara, are there particular acts that, in your experience working with clients, would be helpful in this moment of economic struggle?
I think Congress, and frankly the White House, because it's very clear that they want a package too. I think they're on the right track. I think in times like this, the consumer, the voter, frankly, because we've got an election coming up, needs to have money in their pocket. This isn't an economic downturn. This is a disease-related downturn. Nobody saw it coming. Nobody could have predicted that it occurred as it did. And so I think the smartest thing that all parties can do is to try to enable the average consumer, the average person, to maintain some type of reasonable lifestyle without just decimating their spending and their ability to exist.
And so the unemployment benefit, the $600 a week that people were receiving, is one piece of that. There was discussion of whether another stimulus check might be in order, $600 or $1,200, just a check sort of sent across the board to everyone, at least everyone below a certain income level. Do those do much good, Barbara?
They do. And they went back into the economy very, very quickly. So yes, I read something that indicated that what a lot of people did with that, a high percentage paid back rent. So people who were already kind of falling into the hole, we kind of go back to the evictions there, but they caught up on their rent. So I think for the people that needed it, that was a very valuable feature.
And Sandy, I mean, in your observation of folks out in the community, are there other things that they're crying out for, things that that would actually have an impact on people's everyday financial situation?
Well, I think if you're one of the 16 million who are without a job right now, I think trying to gain employment, because the economy is shifting so rapidly in the unskilled sector. You know, when you have restaurants closing down and yet you have Amazon warehouses popping up, right? Because mm-hmm. a lot of retail has shifted to online. So, you know, you have huge shifts in the economy like that. So things that would facilitate, you know, getting new skills or getting a job where there are jobs, you know, anything that could make that happen quicker mm-hmm. would be helpful.
And another thing, Brian, is that the economy is not going to come back the way it was. We're looking at a new normal or a next normal, if you will. And I think it's going to be much more technology-based. I know, speaking about my own office, we took advantage of being out of the office to upgrade some technology platforms. And kind of going back to our discussion about the stock market not being the economy, that's part of what's powering the stock market. Is that the four largest stocks in the S&P 500 are tech stocks, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, and they're up 24 to 71% year to date. And you're going to see that continue, I think. So the investment in tech is something that may cause people to take a good look at their skills and possibly retool.
One of the elements of the earlier stimulus package were the PPP loans, the Payroll Protection Program loans, something that allowed small businesses to keep paying employees if they kept the employees. Do you see anything more along those lines or anything else for small businesses? Do you see those PPP loans, which are supposed to be designed to be forgiven if they are used as directed, any streamlining of that process? I know a lot of companies struggled at first. Sandy?
Boy, that's an interesting question.
Go ahead, Barbara.
I'm sorry.
I should be directing the question. You're not in the same room. None of us are in the same room. Barbara, go ahead.
The PPP loan process was very confusing. It seemed like it changed on a day-to-day basis. I don't know that that is necessarily going to come back, but the Small Business Administration loans that were made available the second wave still are open. There still is money available. So I would be a bit surprised if they came out with additional funds for the SBA loans simply because there's money that still can be claimed. Mm-hmm. And again, the process, it is just so confusing. We're constantly getting directives from the IRS about, you know, how to interpret this and what to tell your employers to do. And Sandy may be seeing the same thing. So I like the fact that you use the word streamline because, oh my gosh, this process could definitely benefit from that.
Which is maybe true of a lot of government programs. Sandy, are you seeing similar things? Would you have similar observations based on your conversations with clients?
Yes, the PPP loans were helpful and they worked for the businesses that I work with. Again, like Barbara, you know, there are funds left, so there's probably, you know, another round of that will probably not come out. The other thing, though, is you know, businesses may have taken a loan, and now if you're in the wrong sector, say a restaurant, you may realize that you are not going to have a return to normal, and that you can't stay open. So there's no need to prolong it, you know, if you need to go through bankruptcy and close doors.
In the time we have left, I'd be really curious to hear what you are hearing from clients who may or may not be financial experts themselves, but are they worried, or are they willing to sit this out and to see what happens? Is there a lot of anxiety, or are people starting to adapt to this new normal? Let's start with you, Barbara.
I would say that they are both adapting and they are nervous. So one of the things we talked about earlier is that sleep at night factor. I'm getting a lot of phone calls from clients who say, I understand I'm invested for the long term, but I'm further down the road. My goals have become nearer, for example, retirement. Can we take a really good look at my portfolio? Because it's possible that I might want something a little more conservative. We're having a lot of those discussions. And we keep stressing that if you're invested for the long term, probably no changes need to be made. But if you're getting nervous, and if you need money for something soon, or your goal has become closer, we need to be talking about how we're going to create that cash flow or the money you need.
Sandy Weaver, the last word.
Same thing. My clients have been pretty steady Eddies about it. You know, they have diversified portfolios. They've started making all the right moves in terms of raising cash now in this kind of a market to build reserves, especially and funds for upcoming projects. And they have decided how they want to handle COVID in their lives, and they're pretty steady with that.
That's Sandy Weaver. She's founder of Weaver Financial in Mission. And Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Our smart money experts, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
That's it today for Up to Date. Join us tomorrow morning. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.